is Allah.
His eyes had looked dazed and dull when he'd first come out of the room, but I could see them becoming more focused. I didn't understand it. If he was a walker, then why was he able to talk? Or think? He took a step toward me. The first step was wobbly, as if he was uncertain how to use his body, but the second step was firmer. The third step showed no instability at all. Crap. His face took on an expression that was half-triumphant leer and half-naked hunger, and a fanatical light burned like a solar flare in his eyes.
Allah is the only God, and I am his wrath on earth.
Whatever, I said as I dodged to one side and kicked him on the meat of the thigh with the steel toe of my shoe, a blow that would cripple anyone, but again, it did nothing to him.
It's funny, he said in Farsi. But it doesn't even hurt. Oh, Amira, how I love you.
I made a lunge for my fallen pistol, but El Mujahid leaped at me. Any awkwardness he might have experienced upon returning to life was gone. For all his size, he moved with cat quickness, and he body-blocked me away from the piece and kicked the gun under a desk. I slewed around and came up into a fighting crouch. Okay, I thought. Come on, Joe, you've done this before. Break the neck and you stop these buggers. So I jumped in and tried to grab his chin and hair. Most people have only seen this move in movies. They won't recognize it when someone tries it on them. And it's such a fast move that by the time they figure it out, they're on the cold side of being dead. Unfortunately for me, El Mujahid wasn't a novice. He parried my lunge and hit me in the ribs with a short chopping punch that lifted me completely off the ground. Then he combined off that and planted an overhand right that nearly took my head off. I managed to get a shoulder up in time to save my head, but El Mujahid was a tank and his punch dropped me. I landed hard and immediately tucked into a sideways roll and barely managed to avoid a stamp that would have crushed my skull. The First Lady was screaming over and over again, and I wondered if her mind had snapped. I came out of my roll on fingertips and toes and tried to reach for the .38 on my ankle, but he rushed me with a flying tackle that sent us both rolling over and over across the floor. At the end of the roll, I managed to get a knee up between us and braced it against his chest as he tried to pull me into a bear hug. With his arms, he'd have splintered my back. I drove my shoulders back and used the greater power of my legs to break his grab. He skidded back, and I again went for my pistol, this time getting it out. But El Mujahid threw himself forward like a dolphin jumping out of the water onto the side of the pool. It was a sloppy move, all momentum. But it worked. And he made a big reach and swatted the pistol out of my hand. So I kicked him in the face and back rolled to my feet. I had my back to the wall and he was between me and any guns. He rose slowly, head down, shoulders hunched, hands forward and out. This was a son of a bitch who really knew how to fight. Without rules, just react and destroy, like me. Past him, I could see parts of the tussle that was going on behind the desk, legs and arms, and a lot of cursing. I had no idea who was winning that fight. El Mujahid stalked me, cutting left and right to try and box me into the corner. Against most opponents, a corner is a pretty good place to make a stand. It allows for a lot of options when flight is no longer in the mix. But with a fighter like this bruiser, it would be a death trap. He leered at me and bit the air with a clack of teeth.
I think I'll take a bite out of you,
he said, pitching it to sound like a joke. I wasn't laughing. I could still hear gunfire and screams coming from the bell chamber. It must be one hell of a battle in there. Would Grace survive it, or had she already fallen? Would she rise as one of the mindless walkers, or as a new and improved thinking monster like the one I faced? What would Church and the President do? Let everyone in the Liberty Bell Center kill each other and then torch the whole place? Could the President risk any other response, even with his wife here? Then I realized that the First Lady was no longer screaming. El Mujahid noticed, too, and we both turned to see that she had picked up my .45 and was pointing it at the big terrorist. She fired, but in her panic she jerked the trigger instead of squeezing it, and the gun bucked upward and the shot punched a hole in the ceiling. I rushed in her direction, wanting that damn gun, but El Mujahid lunged in to cut me off, pawing at me with a fast grab. I parried it, but it was a fake, and he snaked the other hand in and caught me by the sleeve of my suit jacket. The First Lady got off another shot, but it just tore a chunk out of El Mujahid's hip. jerked me forward with such force that I flew off the ground and he hit me with an elbow shot that broke a black bomb in my head. I sagged in his grip, and as he bent toward me I could feel his hot breath on my exposed throat. Chapter 123. Galt and Amira, the bunker. Galt scrambled forward in a panic, feeling for the etched markings as Amira's eerie voice floated through the darkness toward him, louder each time she called his name.
Sebastian.
She drew it out, making it a perverse song. His fingers scrabbled across an uneven spot on the wall, and he stopped fumbling at it. Yes! He felt for the upper right corner of the panel and then punched it with the side of his fist. The corner folded inward, and he gripped the edges and tore the whole panel away. A small red light flicked on inside the compartment, illuminating the rubber-coated handles of six big levers.
Sebastian!
Which? He breathed and grabbed the first handle and pulled. It was much harder than he thought it would be, and the angle was bad. He had to stand hunched over and throw his entire weight backward to move the handle. On the first pull, it only moved 5 inches.
Bastard!
He growled and tried again, screaming with effort. This time the handle tilted toward him and locked into place. There was an anticlimactic silence for a few seconds, and then far away there was a heavy rumbling that he felt more than heard. He grabbed the second handle, and again it took him 2 pulls to lock it down.
Sebastian!
Her voice was close. God, he thought. God! Even as the rumbling started for the second collapsing vent pipe, he threw himself back with the third, and this one locked down on the first try. The rumbling started at once.
Sebastian!
Now there was a different tone in her voice. Perhaps a faint flicker of doubt. He grabbed the fourth lever and pulled. It was so hard, so stiff, that it took him 5 tries to lock it down, but finally it clicked and the rumbling started.
Sebastian!
He could hear the hurried scuff of her feet, and her voice definitely had a note of alarm in it. It gave him strength to hear the fear, and he tackled the fifth lever with a will, and in 2 grunting pulls it locked down. Already the ambient temperature was rising as the superheated gases began recoiling from blocked vents. A deep red glow was reflected through the steel passages, and it bathed him in a bloody light.
Sebastian!
He turned, and she was there, not 20 feet away. Her robes were torn, and she was covered in blood. God knows whose blood it was. In the fiery glow of the lava, she looked like a monster from hell itself. The blood on her lips and hands was black, and her eyes were so shadowed that she looked more like a skull than a woman whose beauty had once made him gasp with but a single slanting glance.
"Listen to me, Sebastian," she said, her voice thick and heavy. "Stop this. I can share Generation 12 with you. If you truly embrace the Koran and the teachings of the Prophet, I can make you one of us. I can make you one of God's immortals."
"You're insane, Amira. You've turned yourself into a monster."
He put his hand on the sixth lever.
"I am Saif al-Din,"
she retorted, her dark eyes flashing.
"Don't you understand? I am the plague. I am the sword of the faithful. We don't need laboratories or test subjects anymore. I am the breath of God that will blow across the entire world. The faithless will die and the faithful will become immortals. Like me. Like El Mujahid."
She reached a hand toward him.
"Like you, Sebastian. If you only accept."
He shook his head and tears spilled down his cheeks.
"I'm a greedy, heartless bastard, Amira, but I'm not a monster."
Amira spread her hands and smiled at him.
"Am I a monster, my love?"
she said in that old, familiar voice that turned a knife in his heart. It was so bizarrely at odds with the blood-stained thing she had become. "Yes, you effing well are," the answering voice came from the shadow behind her. "Toys." Amira turned to look behind her, and there was Toys, his clothes torn, his face streaked with blood, his eyes swimming with pain. He leaned one bloody hand against the wall, and with the other he held his pistol aimed at her. The barrel trembled. Amira hissed at him, and Toys managed a mean little smile and hissed back. He looked past her at Galt and at the lever he held in his hands. Toys took a ragged breath.
"Do it,"
he said. Amira swung back toward Galt.
"No!"
"God,"
he said softly as the mountains rumbled around him and the heat scorched the air between them.
"I loved you, Amira."
"Sebastian,"
they both said it. Amira and Toys. Galt tightened his grip around the handle and tensed his muscles.
"God help me," he murmured. "But I will always love you."
She lunged at him as Toys fired the gun, and Galt threw his weight back and pulled the lever. Their screams were lost in the rumble as tons of rock collapsed onto the last pipe. In the bowels of the earth, in the furnace of hell, the hand of Satan clutched its fiery fingers into a fist and punched upward toward the bunker. Chapter 124. The Liberty Bell Center, Saturday, July 4th, 12:21 p.m. His breath was as hot as the wind from hell, and I recoiled from it, twisting in his grip, turning my hips as hard and fast as I could. I drove my knee up into his crotch and at the same time drove the stiffened tips of my fingers up under his jaw, crushing tissue and cartilage above the Adam's apple. Another killing blow that I knew couldn't kill him, but it jolted him so that his head jerked back just enough for me to hit him right over his left ear. Once, twice, three times, rocking his whole body with each shot. I could hear his neck bones grind with the third shot, and then El Mujahid suddenly flung me away from him. Maybe when he felt his vertebrae start to shift, he realized his one vulnerability. I landed hard and tried a back roll, but I didn't have the room and crashed into a filing cabinet, so I ended up nearly standing on my head. My own neck sent a lance of pain through my shoulder and back, but I bit down on it, planted my palms on the floor, and hopped backward onto my feet. It wasn't gold medal gymnastics, but it got me right side up, and I pivoted fast as El Mujahid rushed at me again. The First Lady shot again and missed, and then the slide locked back on the gun. I knew I couldn't keep this up. I was getting tired, and I was getting hurt, and this son of a bitch was immortal. He was a monster who couldn't feel pain. Sooner or later, he was going to wear me down, and then he'd go to work on me with his teeth. Across the room, I heard someone howl in pain, and couldn't tell if it was Skip or Top, and I couldn't spare the second it would take to look. I crabbed sideways to circle him, but he lunged forward to cut the line. That was fine, because as he dodged in, I jumped sideways to pass him on his left. His sweeping grab clipped my ear, and though it rang my chimes, it didn't stop me. I used the impact to spin into a sloppy pirouette that sent me halfway across the office toward one of the artist's tables. At the far end of the table, I'd seen what I wanted, but El Mujahid was already coming at me, his face almost black with rage, and his teeth snapping as he rushed forward. Rage, in an opponent, is a very useful thing. It makes smart people do stupid things. If you backpedal from the enraged attacker, you simply get smashed against a wall and then he proceeds to beat you to a pulp, or, in this case, tear you apart with his teeth. So I didn't backpedal. Instead, I went forward to meet him, not chest to chest like a pair of bulls. I lunged in and down and tucked myself into a cannonball and rolled hard at his lower legs, hitting him full onto his left shin and clipping his right. With his greater upper body weight and my 200 pounds of rolling mass, he went flying forward and smashed face first into a row of metal cabinets. I came out of my roll, pivoted, and leaped back toward the artist's table, grabbing at the item I'd seen, a big paper cutter that was bolted to the metal tabletop. I yanked the cutter arm up, grabbed the handle with both hands, and surged my weight to my right. The bolt that hinged the big blade to the cutter board was not designed for sideways resistance, and the whole cutter arm tore off with a loud snap of broken fittings. I whirled, and El Mujahid was already in motion, coming hard and fast, deadly and fearless, completely unhurt by the collision with the cabinets. Again I rushed to meet him in the middle of his lunge, but this time I swung the big cutter like a sword, the curved blade whistling through the air. I caught him square right on the left side of his neck, and the edge of the blade bit deep. The impact jerked El Mujahid to an abrupt stop, and he goggled at me, his eyes and mouth gaping in shock. His fingers reached up to feel the heavy blade buried into muscle and tendon. It hadn't cut all the way through his neck, but the very edge of the blade must have buried itself in the big man's spinal cord. Half an inch was enough. His immense strength immediately began to melt away as his muscles lost all order and control. He dropped to his knees like a supplicant preparing to abase himself. Gasping for breath, I braced one foot against his body and then ripped the handle free in a spray of blood.
"You can't stop the will of God," he said with a throat that was filled with blood. "This was never about God's will, you stupid bastard,"
I growled as I raised it above my shoulder, and then with a scream of pure rage, I swung the blade again. The blade sheared all the way through what was left of his neck, and the force of the swing tore the cutter from my hands. It buried itself point first in the linoleum floor and stood there, quivering. El Mujahid's head bounced and then rolled to a stop, his wild eyes staring with infinite shock up to the heavens. I staggered back and almost fell. The First Lady screamed. Then I heard another cry of pain and turned, my body tingling with nervous tension, my mind reeling from what I'd just done. And I saw Skip Tyler coming toward me, a bloody knife in one hand. He looked at me, and then down at the terrorist. He smiled with bloody teeth.
"Well," he said hoarsely, "aren't you the goddamn hero?"
And then his eyes rolled up in their sockets and he fell flat on his face. There were half a dozen pencils jammed into a tight grouping in his back, buried deep into the right kidney. A bloody, trembling shape climbed up from behind the desk. Top was covered with cuts and painted with blood.
"Tough little son of a bitch," he said.
He coughed and slumped down to his knees, catching himself with one arm on the desk. The First Lady and I both rushed to him. She got there first, and she helped him down into a sloppy sitting position. Her face was as flushed as his. I wobbled toward them, and then my legs gave out, and I almost fell. Top waved me off.
"I'll live, Captain, but give me a second to catch my breath."
He lowered his head and sat there, dripping blood onto the floor. The First Lady stroked his hair and held on to him, both giving and taking comfort.
"Did you get him?"
a voice asked, and I turned to see Ollie Brown peering up at me with one half-opened eye. I tottered over and sank down beside him. He was in bad shape. I looked at Top and shook my head. Top winced and hung his head.
"Hey, kid," I said, putting my hand on Ollie's shoulder. "You hold on now." "Bastard blindsided me. O'Brien, son of a bitch, was the—"
he began and then coughed bloody phlegm onto the floor.
"I should have figured it out. Sorry for letting you down."
His voice was almost gone. I took his hand and held it just as I'd held Roger Jefferson's. And like Jefferson, Ollie held on tightly as if through it he could cling to life.
"He fooled us all. It wasn't your fault.
If anything, Ollie," I said, "it was mine." He shook his head.
"Was it Skip? Was he the one?"
"Yeah."
"You get him, too?"
Top did.
"Yeah, that baby face,"
he smiled weakly.
Guess it was easier to think it was me."
"I'm sorry I ever doubted you, Ollie." He coughed.
"Shit happens, Cap."
He tried to turn his head.
"I can't hear gunshots. Is it over?"
I listened, and he was right. There was only silence from the bell chamber. I turned to look down at Ollie, wanting to give him some comfort, but for him it was already over. His eyes were open, but he was looking into a whole different world. I bowed my head and held his hand. Behind me down the hallway I could hear new sounds, running steps, voices. It took a lot for me to raise my head and look as several figures rushed into the room. Bunny was first, his face streaked with blood and his pistol in a two-hand grip. Gus Dietrich was right behind him.
And then she was there. Grace. Alive. All of them. Alive.
"Joe!" she cried and rushed to me, and I pulled her to me, down on the floor.
"We stopped it, boss," growled Bunny, who was bending over top, his face lined with concern.
Grace wrapped her arms around me, and I held Ollie's hand. A man I'd mistrusted and wronged. And I wept for all of us. Chapter 125. The Liberty Bell Center, Saturday, July 4th, 12:28 p.m. A fresh wave of Secret Service agents were the first to enter the Liberty Bell Center. Dressed in hazmat suits, they surged through the building until they found the First Lady. They whisked her away through a back door. Paramedics came to get us. Bunny lingered in the doorway to the office where Ollie and the others lay dead. EMTs worked on top Sims, putting compresses on over a dozen slashes and stab wounds before loading him onto a gurney. Bunny hovered over them like a mother hen, giving them evil looks every time he thought they were a little too rough. He followed them out, offering a string of suggestions on how to do their jobs. They were probably happy their protective suits hid their faces. I later learned that Skip Tyler had 16 broken bones and a ruptured liver, apart from all the pencils Top had rammed through his kidney. Must have been one hell of a fight. But I was only marginally sorry I missed it. I'd had enough of violence. Maybe enough for the rest of my life. Even the warrior who lurked in the back of my soul was glutted for now. Ollie Brown and the fallen Secret Service agents were zippered into black rubber body bags. Skip and El Mujahid were left to lie where they were. Forensics teams would need to take pictures first. They could rot for all I cared. The EMTs all stopped and stared at the two pieces of El Mujahid. They gave me strange looks and didn't get too close.
Grace sat beside me, her hand on my shoulder, as the EMTs plastered me with bandages and ice packs. When they were done, I said, "How bad was it?" She was a long time answering that. "Bad," was all she said. I took her hand and held it. Her fingers were cold as ice. "Rudy?" I asked, afraid of the answer. She nodded. "Safe." When I felt able to walk, she and I went back to the bell chamber. Brierly saw us and came over.
"They tell me you and your man saved the First Lady."
"Men," I corrected. "First Sergeant Bradley Sims and Lieutenant Oliver Brown. They both did their part, and Ollie died in action." I paused. "I wanted you to know that Ollie died serving his country." Brierly nodded.
"Thanks, Captain. He was a good man."
"Yes," I said. "He was." We shook hands, and he took Grace aside for a conference call with Church.
"I'll be back," she said.
"I still owe you a drink."
"Yes," she said, giving me a sad little smile. "You bloody well do." There were no more crowds. The victims lay in rows, and men in white plastic suits were draping sheets over them and searching for identification. Someone had rigged blue Tyvek tarps over all of the windows, but the crowds were gone. All of Independence Mall had been cleared, and the whole city was under martial law. The National Guard occupied Center City, and dozens of choppers packed with federal agents, scientists, medical personnel, and a lot of other folks were descending on the town. Rudy sat on the edge of the podium, jacket off, sleeves rolled up, the ends of his tie hanging limply from either side of his throat. He looked up at me and started to offer his hand, but both of our hands were stained with blood. He withdrew his hand and sighed.
"Dios mío, cowboy."
"Yeah."
"Bonnie told me that it was Skip after all, not Ollie. We were wrong."
"Everyone was.
Even Church thought that it might be Ollie. Ollie looked best for it. These bastards probably picked Skip as much for his innocent face as for his greedy black heart. They fooled us, and it almost cost everyone here their lives. I sat down next to him, and for a long time neither of us said a word. His gaze was fixed on a point across the room, and I followed his line of sight to where a man in a Hawaiian shirt lay sprawled. Someone had rammed the broken end of a wooden flagpole through his eye socket.
"I didn't know it could be like this," Rudy said at length. "I mean, I've counseled hundreds of cops, but..."
He shook his head. I understood, and I could hear the deep hurt in his voice. But what could I say? We'd all had to do our parts, and I knew there would be long summer nights to come, where we'd sit out in his backyard and watch the stars wheel overhead and drink beer as we talked it through. But that time wasn't now, and we both knew it. Across the room, some of the Secret Service agents were standing like ghosts, their faces pale, their eyes haunted, as they tried not to look at the bodies lying under sheets.
"It must have been terrible for them," Rudy said. "For you too, man."
He shook his head.
"I mostly watched. I'm not sure I could have done what they did. They had to shoot congressmen. Civilians."
"You blame them for gunning down these people?"
"God, no. They're heroes, every one of them."
I nodded. "They don't think so."
"No," he agreed.
"They're marked," I said. "This is what you were talking about. The look on their faces, in their eyes, it'll never go away. Violence always leaves a mark. You taught me that." He sighed.
"We ask so much of the people who protect us, firemen, cops, soldiers. They sign up to do some good, to make a difference. But we sometimes ask too much."
"They're warriors," I said softly. "Some of them will be stronger because of today. For some people, battle is a clarifying experience. It forces all of the senses to come awake. It makes you become totally aware. Totally alive."
"And some of them will be broken because of today," he said quietly. "Not everyone has a warrior soul. You taught me that, Joe. Some people have only so much courage, only so much tolerance for violence, even when it's for the right cause. For some of these people, this may be a breaking point. Today might kill some of those young folks. Not right away, maybe not for 20 years, but a few of them may never shake the memory of what they had to do today, what they were forced to do. They'll know all the logic about how it had to happen, how they had no choice, and for a while, that will keep them steady, but some of them will never survive this. Not ultimately."
I wanted to argue with him, but I knew that he was right. Being a hero doesn't mean that a person can become comfortable with being a killer, too.
"They're going to need you, Rudy."
"I can't help them all."
"They couldn't save all the people here," I said.
Rudy closed his eyes for a moment. Then he stood up and looked down at me.
"And what about you, cowboy? Have you reached your limit?"
When I didn't answer, he sighed and nodded. He patted my shoulder, then turned and walked over to the group of agents. I watched him go. Saw the process of change that happens when he goes from being my friend Rudy to Dr. Sanchez. He always seems bigger, taller, a rock for those who need something to cling to. But I knew the truth. He, too, was marked, and like the rest of us, he would carry this with him forever.
"So, what about me?" I wondered.
I could already feel the shock ebbing within me as the adrenaline washed its way out of my bloodstream, my deep grief and horror was dipping lower and lower. In the reeds there in the back of my mind, the warrior was already beginning to sharpen his knife again. I knew it. I could feel it. I looked at the agents, and all of them looked so young and so hurt. Only one looked back at me and held my gaze. He was in his late 20s, not all that much younger than me, but his eyes were older than his face. His expression reflected less shock than the others. He read my face and I read his, and we exchanged a brief nod that none of the others saw, or if they did, then they didn't understand it. They weren't of the same species as we were. The young agent turned back and listened to Rudy, but I was sure that he was already working through the experience in his own head, the way I was, the way warriors do. He and I did not need to be marked by our experiences. We were born with that mark. Epilogue 1. In all, 91 people died at the Liberty Bell Center. 14 members of Congress were among them. Terrorists were blamed, of course. But in the official version of the story, there was no apocalyptic plague. It was a nerve gas that caused violent behavior. The news footage that had gone out live was a public relations nightmare, but although there were eyewitness accounts of Secret Service agents gunning down unarmed civilians, the president was able to trot out a couple dozen top-flight scientists who babbled on and on about the psychotic effects of the nerve gas. No one who had been in the fight at the center was held responsible for their actions. Blame was focused instead on El Mujahid and his terrorist network, and that worked well as a way of channeling the massive national outrage. In death, he became an even more hated figure than Osama bin Laden. The credit for bagging him was given to the Secret Service. Medals were eventually handed out, though the DMS was kept out of it. A national day of mourning was scheduled for the last day of July. No attempt was made to create a new version of the Freedom Bell. When DMS agents investigated Andrea Lester's apartment, they found correspondence and other evidence linking her to Ahmed Mahoud, a terrorist operative whose body was recovered at the Liberty Bell Center. He'd been one of the infected, and Rudy had taken him down with the broken shaft of a pole for the American flag. If that had gotten into the press, it would have become an iconic moment, but it was never mentioned. Mahoud was later identified as the brother-in-law of El Mujahid, and the investigation clearly established that Lester and Mahoud were lovers. She had secretly converted to Islam more than 3 years ago, long before she was hired to cast the Freedom Bell, and Church speculated that it might have been her connection with the rededication project that inspired the whole terrorist plan. It seemed likely, but we'd probably never know for sure. Director Brierley initiated a hunt to find Robert Howell Lee. They found him in his bedroom at home. He'd driven home after speaking to me on the phone at the Liberty Bell Center, taken his wife's bottle of sleeping pills from the medicine cabinet, written a suicide note that asked for forgiveness, and swallowed the whole bottle. Brierley's people got there with maybe 10 minutes to spare. The EMTs pumped him out, and Mr. Church flexed his muscles and made sure that the ambulance was redirected to a secure location. Church was on the first thing smoking, and by the time Lee had shaken off the effects of the sleeping pills, he woke up to find Mr. Church sitting by the side of his bed. It would have been better if the pills had worked faster. He later admitted to having known about El Mujahid's more deadly strain of the plague, but it was clear he had done nothing to warn the authorities. He said he'd ordered Skip Tyler to prevent El Mujahid from escaping, but even that didn't square with the facts. Lee was a traitor, a coward, and a goddamn fool. Grace and I found Church sitting alone in a deserted anteroom at the FBI field office in Philadelphia, quietly munching vanilla wafers. "Did you learn anything?" I asked, but he was a long time in responding.
"Mr. Church?"
Grace prompted softly. Church drank some water.
"He gave us a name."
He leaned back in his chair and considered the half-eaten cookie he held between thumb and forefinger.
"Sebastian Galt."
Grace blanched.
"No."
She told me who Galt was, but even I'd heard of him. Who hadn't?
"If this is true..."
Church didn't look at her.
"It's true. Lee was ultimately..."
He paused and thought about the right word.
forthcoming.
God, this will hurt a lot of people. Church nodded. I called Aunt Sally. She's initiated a worldwide search for him, very quiet but very thorough. Grace shook her head.
So, this was all for money?
No, he said. For Galt, it clearly was, but not for El Mujahid. He was doing this for his God. He said as much to Captain Ledger, and Lee verified it. He said that Galt had been funding the terrorists with the agenda of scaring the U.S. into backing out of the Middle East. It's what you thought, Captain, and it probably would have worked, but El Mujahid apparently had a separate agenda, and he really was trying to release the plague. And it was worse even than that. He wasn't just willing to die for his cause, he was willing to become a monster. He had no use for Galt's money. What good would it be to him? To what he became.
What was he? I asked. He clearly wasn't a walker.
Yes, he was. We found Ahmed Mahoud's car. There were two spent vials of a different strain of the pathogen. Who's labeled it a transformative mutation? It kept the oxygen flowing to El Mujahid's brain, so there was no loss of higher function. Who surmises that El Mujahid planned to share that version with other fundamentalists so that even if the plague got out of hand and they were infected, they would still retain awareness, and with awareness, faith.
He sighed.
Who tells me that the version of the pathogen fired from the Freedom Bell was yet another strain, far more virulent?
He looked at me.
If you hadn't ordered Brierly to seal the doors at the Liberty Center?
God.
Grace breathed. I couldn't think of anything to add to that.
Church pushed the plate of cookies over to me without any further comment. Grace and I both had one.
2. A pillar of smoke rose 300 feet above the smoking pit that still burned deep in the Helmand province of Afghanistan. British Army helicopters circled the vicinity and satellites were retasked to probe the region. Something had happened deep beneath the sands that no seismograph had predicted. There were known spots of deeply buried geothermal activity, but nothing like this had happened in over 100 years. It would take years to uncover the cause.
3. About 10 days later, I found Church in his office at the warehouse. I'd heard that he was moving back to the hangar at Floyd Bennett Field.
Are you closing the warehouse?
No. You and Grace can run it. We need a base here. I liked the sound of that, but I kept the smile off my face. Grace and I had been too busy to share that drink since the Liberty Bell Center catastrophe, but we had a rendezvous planned for tonight. From the secret smiles she'd been giving me, I thought we might go beyond the platonic sleepover. I pulled up a chair and sat down.
So, where are we? I asked him.
Church set down the papers he had been sorting and spread his hands.
We saved the world, Captain Ledger, more or less.
And we certainly saved the economy of the United States. We also took down a major terrorist network. We're heroes, and we have the thanks of a grateful nation, though no one will ever say so. But along the way, we embarrassed a lot of people and made a few enemies. The Vice President's wife would like to see Major Cortland's head on a pike. On the other hand, the First Lady wants you and First Sergeant Sims canonized.
What will all that mean for us?
Us?
For the DMS, I said.
Church shrugged.
We're still open for business.
I looked him straight in the eyes.
Who are you, Church?
Just a government paper pusher.
Bullshit.
Who do you think I am?
Grace thinks you can keep all of the Washington power players at bay because you know where the bodies are buried.
He gave me the bleakest, saddest smile I'd ever seen.
I should, he said softly.
I buried a lot of them.
4. That night, as Grace lay in my arms, we talked about things. We were both naked. The bier, untouched, sat on the floor amid a tangle of clothes. Some of the clothes were ripped, mine and hers.
So, you're staying with us?
She asked. I knew she meant the DMS, but as usual, she'd implied a bunch of other meanings.
Sure. Rudy signed on. Jerry, too.
I paused and flexed my fingers, which were intertwined with hers.
I think I've found a home here. Grace was silent for a long, long time.
Me too,
she said.
I closed my eyes and pulled her closer to me.
5. The medical ship HMS Agatha pitched and yawed slowly in the sluggish rollers that wandered across the Arabian Sea. It was a blistering night in mid-July, and the staff had brought some of the more ambulatory soldiers on deck to allow them to get some relief from the sluggish breeze that moved across the wavetops. Some of the men and women were so badly injured that even the breeze gave no trace of relief, and of these, the burn victims suffered most. Hot winds, poor air conditioning below decks, and salt spray were each separate tortures. But the man who sat alone in a wheelchair by the stern rail never voiced a single word of complaint. His face and hands were swathed heavily in gauze, and one eye was clouded to a milky whiteness. The doctors had said that it had been virtually boiled in his skull. How the man had made it through the desert was a total mystery. He had no fingerprints left, but a DNA test revealed that his name was Stephen Garrett, a medic assigned to a British unit that had been virtually wiped out during a series of suicide raids by insurgents. The burned man was incoherent with pain, and once he'd been medevaced to the air station and then shuttled to the Agatha, he'd lapsed into a total silence. His experiences had broken him, the doctors agreed. Poor man. The ship steered west toward the Gulf of Aden and then turned northwest into the Red Sea. The burned man watched the sun set over the rocky hills. He closed his eyes and bowed his head. Next to him sat a slim young man with cat-green eyes and dark hair. He too was burned, but not badly. He wore a bandage on his face and one on his neck, and even though his hands were wrapped in gauze, he held the other man's hand, like a father would, or a brother. The badly burned man looked at him for a while and then stared back at the setting sun.
Amira,
he whispered. His companion patted his hand again and smiled.
Shh,
Toys whispered as the ship plowed on out of troubled waters.
Author's note. Much of the technical information in this novel is based upon actual science. With very few exceptions, the surveillance equipment, computer systems, and weapons used by the fictional Department of Military Sciences are real, though several of these items are not yet available on the commercial market. Prion diseases, including fatal familial insomnia, are also real. The parasites and control diseases used by Gen 2000, however, are purely fictitious, though inspired by similar pathogens currently present in science. A great number of people have provided help, advice, and technical information. Any technical errors still remaining are mine. Also, thanks to Michael Cecilia of Homeland Security, the superb team at the Philadelphia Forensic Science Bureau led by Chief Inspector Keith R. Sadler and Captain Daniel Castro, Ken Caluzzi, Chief of Lower Makefield Police Department, Frank Sessa,
Dr. Bruno Vincent of the Institut de Pharmacologie Moléculaire et Cellulaire,
Kenneth Story, Ph.D., Carleton University, Powell P. Liberski, M.D., Department of Molecular Pathology and Neuropathology,
Medical University of Lodz,
and Peter Lucas, M.D.
This concludes the reading of Patient Zero by Jonathan Mayberry, copyright 2009 by Jonathan Mayberry. This book was read by Ray Porter. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with St. Martin's Press and was produced in 2010 by Blackstone Audio, Inc., which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose
without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audio, Inc. Thank you.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.